Let's get together, talk about the movies that we saw this week. We'll have discussions, talk film news, we'll laugh a lot and act like geeks. Sometimes we'll have a guest or two, sometimes it's just the two of us. Let's crack some jokes and tell some folks to come along and hang with us!
Mike and Mike go to the movies. Mike and Mike go to the movies. Yeah!
You have chosen wise.
Hello and welcome to the podcast from the mind of M. Night Shyamalan. It's Film Book Cast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who will cycle through 24 different personalities for the duration of this podcast.
Mike DiCriscio.
How you doing today, Mike?
I'm feeling a little set up for failure.
I really wanted to
notified of that beforehand.
I wanted to put your improv skills to the test.
Nope. It's nope just end, straight, right? Just is how it goes?
Nope end. Yeah, that's the universal rule for improv.
Yes.
So we'll cycle through a few of those, hopefully, throughout the podcast. We'll see what happens. And returning to the podcast this time around, our first guest of 2019, Nick Wormuth. Welcome back to Film Bookcast.
It is such an honor, and I hope you don't spring any characters on me, because I am just as ill-prepared as Mike.
Fair enough. Now, you were on back when we did our Halloween episode, and more recent listeners might recognize you from our Top 10 episode, where you gave a very impassioned defense of Paddington 2 as your number one movie of the year, and we respect you for it here at Film Book Cast.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, but apparently the Oscars doesn't respect Paddington enough, but...
The Academy doesn't listen, I don't think.
I don't think...
The Academy has no heart.
I don't think Paddington concerns himself with such trivial matters as awards, but...
It doesn't mean it doesn't hurt me.
Fair enough. So credit for all our theme songs go to Kyle Cullen. And if you want to contact us, you can send us an email at mikeandmikegotothemovies@gmail.com. Now, if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I, this time Nick joins us, will discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our featured review. This week, we are talking M. Night Shyamalan's big culmination of what has been dubbed the Eastrail 177 trilogy. It's Glass. Now, were you guys excited about Glass?
If I say no, are you going to be mad at me?
No, I won't be mad at you. I know we reviewed Split a couple of years ago, and I feel like you liked Split. I feel like you had a pretty good time with it. But I remember the very end of the movie, which I guess is not really a spoiler anymore because Glass exists, but but the very end of Split reveals that it's been a secret sequel to Unbreakable this whole time. And when you saw Split, you had actually not seen Unbreakable, so that twist fell completely flat for you.
Right. Yeah, so. I knew it meant it was part of Unbreakable, but I didn't see Unbreakable, so I didn't know what that meant.
Right. So so you weren't that hyped for Glass, is what you're saying.
No, I mean, like, a little bit, but not a whole lot. No.
Okay, fair enough. Nick, what about you? Were you excited for Glass?
Last time I was excited for an M. Night Shyamalan movie was The Village, and since then I've kind of learned to just tamper my expectations.
Oh, man.
Well, I am with you there. I think The Village is terrible. And honestly, I was with you on that front for a very long time. M. Night Shyamalan was a joke. Like, you know, he had a couple of good movies, right? Like, a couple of very good movies in the early 2000s, and then there's a very long stretch of really bad movies. But I don't know, around when he came out with The Visit, I was like, hey, this is pretty good. And then he came out with Split, and I was like, hey, this is pretty good again. I'm into this. And so I was actually pretty psyched for Glass, like M. Night kind of returning to one of his original worlds, one of his like good movies. Yeah, I was pretty stoked for Glass, and the reviews of this movie have been really interesting to read. The reactions online have been all over the place, so I'm very curious to see what you guys think of the movie, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But right now, let's talk about some film news. All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and I think we should begin with probably the biggest news, which was that the Oscar nominations were just announced to you guys. Now, this is a pretty big deal every year, you know, what movies got nominated, and I will say I was pretty underwhelmed by by the nominees this year in general. But Nick, let's hear your thoughts first. I know you, me and you were like texting back and forth on the day of with our different Oscars hot takes. So what do you think of this group of nominees?
I think it's basically most of them are just there to fill out like some form of checkbox. And it's kind of the most unexciting Oscar race, I think, of probably the last decade. If Bohemian Rhapsody can get nominated for anything, then they should also just put, like, I don't know, like Tomb Raider or Pacific Rim Uprising. Just things that are fleetingly fun, but then really offer nothing else. And other than that, the other categories are basically the same as they are most other years, so I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. Mike, what about you? Did you look into this at all, the Oscar nominees? Do you have any idea what's nominated? I know you really don't care about these awards, from what I understand, right?
No, you know what? And that's the thing I've been thinking about recently, where I used to be really hyped and, like, would follow the Oscars and, like, all this, their buzz and stuff. But, like, the last year or two, ain't nobody got time for this shit, man. I don't care. Like, these nominees I've had, like, basically no reaction to. I think we went through them last week, and I had seen one of them, and I still had an opinion.
And the one you had seen was Black Panther, which is what everyone saw, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because there were so many that just, like, I had no, like, I don't really have a desire to see A Star is Born and The Green Book or Bohemian Rhapsody. Like, I just don't care about any of those movies.
Right.
And now there's no host, and they're cutting some of the songs out. Yeah. So, like, if I'm not going to see Tim Blake Nelson, what's the point? Like, cancel the whole thing.
Yeah, no, I am 100% with you on there. So I'll run down the nominees here for Best Picture. There are 8 nominees, and they are Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, The Favorite, Green Book, Roma, A Star is Born, and Vice. I've seen all these movies, and I think of these movies, I think 5 of them are at least good. You know, I like Black Panther, Black Klansman, The Favorite, Roma, and A Star is Born. Then you have Bohemian Rhapsody, Green Book, and Vice, which I would say Green Book is the best of those 3, and that's a bad sign. Green Book is fine. It's I talked about all these movies in the podcast in discussions in the past, and Green Book is the one where it's like, it's the most amiable, like, fine time. It's the one that you can show to, like, your grandparents and have a good time watching it with them, you know? And that feels like the contingent of the Academy who are really pushing hard for Green Book is the old white guys. And, you know, the disappointing thing here, I mean, last year, like, The Shape of Water won Best Picture. The movie about the lady who fucks a fish won Best Picture. And it was a well-deserved award. Like, it was a really great movie. Del Toro won Best Director, too. Like, that was awesome. And this year, it just seems like there are more pedestrian choices, I guess. There are a couple of some standout things I wanted to point out, though. I will say that Roma is my personal favorite of the movies that are nominated for Best Picture. It's very rare for a foreign language movie to get in that category in the first place, so that's pretty huge. Also, very first Netflix original movie to get nominated for the Oscars, or at least in the Best Picture, or in one of the major categories. To me, that's pretty huge. That's like a kind of a signal of, like, the entire industry starting to shift. Like, if Netflix can get nominated for Oscars, like, what else can it do, you know?
Hopefully win an Oscar.
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, and I honestly, I think, you know, right, it seemed for a while like Green Book was the front runner, which, again, would be terrible. But it's like, you know, I don't know. There are certain things you can look at in terms of, like, how these the awards season goes. And Green Book did not get a Best Director nomination, which is usually key if you want that Best Picture win. Not always the case. I mean, Argo won Best Picture. Ben Affleck wasn't nominated for Best Director for that movie. But still, most of the time, there needs to be at least a nomination there. But Rome, from what I understand, from what I was able to suss out online, it seems like sort of the front runners are Roma and Black Klansman, and those are probably the 2 best movies here. So, like, there is that.
That worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What happened to A Star is Born, though? That's what I want to know, because I felt like back in October, that was the one that was going to sweep everything, and just, like, especially with the Globes and the SAG After Awards, I think, they didn't win anything, really.
It's insane. They've been winning Best Original Song for Shallow, which is a slam dunk. There's no way that song wasn't going to win Best Original Song. The thought was, like, Lady Gaga was going to win Best Actress. Bradley Cooper was going to win Best Director. He wasn't even nominated for Best Director for A Star is Born. He was nominated for Best Actor. But yeah, A Star is Born, it seems like that classical Hollywood movie that, like, logically should sweep.
I mean, there's 4 other ones, so.
Right. But
3 other ones.
Everything you know about the Oscars it like it just makes sense that A Star Is Born would be the movie to kind of rally around and be like, hey, this is actually a pretty good movie, and it fits all the Oscars checkboxes, so like it'll probably win everything. And it was also really popular. It made a lot of money. So it did a lot of those things. It checked them off well, but for some reason, it just completely has died out this award season, which has been shocking. And for some reason, Green Book has been taking over. Like, what? That's still blowing my mind. And I mean, we didn't really talk about the Golden Globes when they aired. We kind of like, I meant to talk about them in like a film news discussion, and I completely forgot about them because they're the Golden Globes.
Whoops.
But you know, Green Book won best drama, Green Book won best comedy there, yeah. And Bohemian Rhapsody won best drama, which like, you know, the comedy is a category with musical. So it's like, why even have the musical category if you're not going to put Bohemian Rhapsody there? I don't know. It doesn't matter. But yeah, of these movies, I mean, it's just weird that Bohemian Rhapsody is in here. That's a movie that did not get great reviews. You know, it's like these other movies like Green Book and Vice, I think they at least got like, you know, semi-decent reviews for not overwhelmingly great, you know, but definitely reviews that reflected like some level of quality here. The Bohemian Rhapsody, like, barely fresh in Rotten Tomatoes, but at the same time, it's like it's a movie that is coasting on the goodwill of Queen. Like, the people just love the music of Queen, and I've said many times, if you can add the music of Queen to anything, and it will seem good. and Bohemian Rhapsody is proof of that in movie form. But you know, Rami Malek is nominated for Best Actor here. And apparently he's like the front runner now, which is driving me insane because like that performance is like 60% false teeth and like 40 yeah. And like 40% just like a silly English accent. Like, you know, he's not even doing his singing in the movie. It's old Freddie Mercury recordings.
Yeah. Like,
of these Oscar nominations, is there anything you liked about these? Anything you wanted to like just throw out there? Like, hey, this is a pretty cool nomination thrown out there.
Nope.
No.
Okay.
I don't know anything off any of the weird. Well, I guess the when a cowboy trades his spurs for wings, or whatever the hell right. That song is.
There's actually a little bit of a lot of Buster Scruggs love throughout these nominations. I think it was nominated for like 3 awards, including Best Original Song, which was amazing. Not the song that I would have picked from the movie, but just I'm glad that it got a nomination there. It also got nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, which is a pretty cool one, and something else. I think it was maybe cinematography or editing, or I don't have that.
Was it costume
design? Technical?
It was costume design, okay. Actually. You're right. Yes, costume design. It's one of the categories that will not be broadcast on the show for some reason.
Did they announce officially everything that was getting cut out? Because I just heard about the music parts.
No, they haven't officially announced anything yet, but it looks like what's going to be happening. And again, this is ridiculous, is that they're cutting out 3 of the 5 Best Original Song performances. So they're only going to have Shallow and All the Stars play. They're also going to be cutting out a lot of the tech awards, or they're actually going to be airing them during commercials. So the commercials will be, people in the room will see them, but you won't be able to watch them on TV. And it's complete horseshit. It's the dumbest move.
Yeah. You can award a movie, but you can't award any of the work that went into making it, kind of. That seems very superficial.
You know, and this is the Oscars are like a huge night in Hollywood. Like, these are people who worked very hard to get where they are. And those categories are like the unsung heroes of movies. Like, it's their, you know, 30 seconds of glory that they get, you know, in their entire career to go up on stage and like give their acceptance speech or whatever. And it just seems very like, it seems really shitty. For that reason, you know? So apparently, like, they're cutting out, you know, probably the Sound Awards, but the one that really bugged me was they're actually cutting out the Best Cinematography Award, from what I hear.
What?
Yeah. Like, Cinematography Award, that's a pretty fucking important award. You're rewarding a visual medium. That's the category that rewards that. You know, it's just weird. So, yeah, the ceremony, like, everything that goes into the planning of the ceremony this year just seems like a clusterfuck. I mean, obviously there's no host still. And that's another thing. Like, you know, they're trying to make, it seems like they want to make the ceremony shorter, which I guess is fine. Like, whatever. But like, you don't have a host, and you're cutting out 3 of the songs, and you're cutting out a lot of the tech awards. Then, like, what the fuck is left?
Make it a 1-hour pre-tape special and like call it a day already. Yeah. Like, forget it.
Yeah, like nobody's tuning into the Oscars just to see like a list of awards being announced. You know, they want like, you know, an actual show. So it's just very weird all around what they're doing this year. But anyway, those are the best picture stuff. I wanted to just highlight a couple of things. The best director category, Spike Lee nominated there, which is pretty cool. The first time he's ever been nominated for best director. For Black Lantern,
which is crazy.
That's insane. Yeah, I mean, he should have been nominated for Do the Right Thing 30 years ago, and this seems like, you know. I think he has a pretty good chance of actually winning that award as like a kind of like a career, like, you know, this year, Lifetime Achievement Award sort of thing, you know? And Alfonso Cuarón's in there, too. If Spike Lee doesn't win, I think Alfonso Cuarón will probably win. Yorgos Lanthimos for The Favorite. Adam McKay for Vice, which is the one I would take out. And I love Adam McKay, but, like, man, that's... Just come on. And then one that was actually kind of surprising and pretty cool, a movie that I have not seen yet, Pavel Polakowski for Cold War got nominated for Best Director. And Cold War is a Polish movie that's nominated in the Best Foreign Language Film category as well. But that was, I think, probably the biggest surprise of any of these categories, is that that movie got some love outside of the Best Foreign Film category. But yeah, otherwise, any other Oscar thoughts, guys, or should we move on into some other film news?
I think 10 years ago when they expanded it to 9 or 10 nominees that they could have, that was important. And I think this is the first year where they should have cut it back to 5 if these are the sort of things they're going to nominate. And that's just what I'd like to end that on.
Yeah, fair enough. I will say, I think I would rather, like the way they do it now, which is dumb, is it's like it can be anywhere between 5 and 10.
Yeah.
Right? But it used to be, they did, for a couple of years, it was like it had to be 10 nominees. And I kind of liked it then, because you were rewarding more movies. So I think if they brought it back up to 10 nominees, there might be 2 good movies that got in there that weren't nominated this time. And so the fact that, like, Green Book, Vice, and Bohemian Rhapsody are in there selling up the Best Picture category might be overshadowed, because there's, like, 2 more, like, really good movies that are also nominated for Best Picture, right? Or cut back down to 5 and get... But if they cut it back down to 5, do you think Green Book, Vice, or Bohemian Rhapsody would not get nominated? Or do you think they would be the ones in the 5?
I would hope that at least Vice would get cut. Bohemian Rhapsody, I think, is just living off the goodwill of the Golden Globes, which is just a money thing anyway. But it's just... It's so baffling to me. Especially when, like, last year they put... I would say that probably Darkest Hour is the only one that probably shouldn't have been there last year, but it's just so...
Last year was a very strong category all around.
Yeah. So, it's just weird that they took such a sharp left turn, and I really have no understanding as to why.
Yeah, it was very, very weird. And I saw somebody positing the idea that, like, even, like, Black Panther could win this award in a sort of, like, Titanic situation, where it's, like, just the biggest, most popular movie of the year takes it. So, we'll see. And I wouldn't hated if Black Panther took that award. I think Black Panther is a very good movie. It's, you know, it would sort of be symbolic of the era of movies that we're in right now. But I think it will go to Roma, and I hope it does, because Roma is my favorite of these movies. But anyway, yeah, speaking of Roma, and speaking of Netflix, I did want to reference one other thing. That's, you know, Roma nominated for Oscars, Netflix getting nominated for Oscars really for the first time, which is pretty big and kind of positions Netflix as a major player in the film industry, and they're going further into that now. Netflix is in talks to join the MPAA, and they would be the first non-traditional studio to do this, which would be kind of nuts. And I kind of wanted to just bring that up because it's you know, the film industry has changed so rapidly over the last few years, and it's pretty much because of Netflix. So it totally makes sense that they would be joining the MPAA, but I'm curious how this would even work, because, like, they don't really, like, they rate stuff on Netflix, but I think, like, they just rate it internally, I guess, right?
I feel like some of the Netflix originals get, like, TVMA rating kind of stuff. I don't know if they get, like, full film rate, like PG-13 or R, right, and stuff like that. So, I mean, maybe they can now? I don't know how that works.
Yeah.
It's going to be weird.
Was Bird Box too violent for TVMA with all that blood and truck gore? So.
I guess so.
Yeah, it must have been it. So I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up because I think it is interesting to note anyway, because, you know, that came out, like, on the same day as those Oscar nominations came out. So I was just, like looking at that and being like, man, Netflix is really, like... Like, they are reshaping things around them, and it's really fascinating to watch that unfold. Now let's talk about some actual, like, upcoming movie news that I did want to get into. This came out a couple days ago. Did either of you ever see The Mummy with Tom Cruise?
No.
You mean the Brendan Fraser one?
Yeah, I mean, as we've established many times in this podcast, Mike, you're a huge fan of the Brendan Fraser Mummy. I think you talked about it on the last episode.
I just wanted to bring it up. That's all.
Lest we forget.
Reiterate.
Yeah. Anyway, The Mummy with Tom Cruise was supposed to kick off what was called the Dark Universe, a shared universe for the Universal Monsters. to, you know, make a like an Avengers style universe for those monsters. And before The Mummy came out, there was Dracula Untold, which was also supposed to do that. And before Dracula Untold came out, The Wolfman came out, which was also supposed to do that. They all failed miserably. Like, they have to keep trying again with different monsters and, like, rebooting their universe every time. Now it's RIP Dark Universe. The Invisible Man is now officially in the works, without Johnny Depp this time. They had cast Johnny Depp when they were going to do the shared universe after The Mummy. Johnny Depp's no longer involved. Invisible Man being made into a movie, and Lee Whannell is directing, the guy who directed Upgrade. Did either of you guys see Upgrade?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I didn't.
Okay, what'd you think of Upgrade, Nick?
I thought it was very, like, action-oriented. It was very interesting, but the story was a bit thin, so I'm not really sure, is The Invisible Man going to be a stylized action movie now? Because that would be very strange to me. Also,
it would be weird to watch an action movie where you can't see the protagonist.
I guess that's true. Couldn't they just still say that it's Johnny Depp no matter what, and people would just believe him?
We'd have no evidence.
You couldn't prove it. That totally makes sense. Yeah, but I think I'm pretty stoked for this. I enjoyed Upgrade. It was a very fun B movie. The action was really cool, and you know, I think Lee Whannell I follow him on Twitter after Upgrade, and he's a pretty interesting guy to follow. I'm all down for this, and I think Invisible Man, if you're gonna do it again, like the Universal Monsters, like Invisible Man is something that hasn't really been done in a really long time.
Well, there's
Hollow
Man.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's Hollow Man. How could you dare say that?
You hold your tongue. How dare you besmirch the legacy of Hollow Man. Who gives a shit?
Fair enough. But it's not like, you know, with The Mummy, there was like three Mummy movies from 99 through 2008 before the Tom Cruise one came out. You know, so, and with like, there's always like Wolfman movies, and there's always like Dracula movies and stuff like that, but you never get Invisible Man movies, except for Hollow
That's
Man.
That's fair.
So, so I'm curious how this works out, and it looks like Blumhouse is actually producing this too. Which gives me a little faith in that, like, they're gonna, you know, just do a kind of low budget thing, let Lee Whannell, like, kind of off the reins, do what he wants. Yeah, I'm down for that. And now let's move on into some blockbustery news, guys. As we talk about the Fast and Furious movies a disproportionate amount in this podcast,
it's rapidly approaching Marvel quantity.
I think it's because they're kind of trying to build out like their own shared universe, which they kind of already had. With the Fast and Furious movies, right? They did, like, Too Fast, Too Furious, where they introduced, like, Tyrese Gibson and Ludacris, and they had Tokyo Drift, which was this entirely separate movie that introduced Han, and then they brought them all together in Fast 5, and it was wild, and that was, like, the Avengers of the Fast and Furious movies, but a year before the Avengers came out.
They did it first.
Yeah, and so now they're kind of trying to do that again. They have this the spinoff coming out next this year, actually, Hobbs and Shaw with The Rock and Jason Statham. Very excited about that movie. And now, according to Vin Diesel, there's going to be a female-centric Fast and Furious spinoff as well. And there's really no other details about it other than that it just will be a team of women set in the Fast and Furious universe, probably consisting of characters that already exist in the Fast and Furious universe. And I'm curious, like, what this movie will be, because, like, at this point in the movies, the only really major female character is Michelle Rodriguez.
Right.
And the girl from Game of Thrones, Natalie Emmanuel is her name.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, she's in those movies, too, now. But like, the only one people care about is Michelle Rodriguez, like, in these movies, you know?
Yeah, just bring everybody back. Why, like, who cares what the story is? No, nobody comes to Fast and the Furious for the story.
I mean, as long as there are cars exploding, like, I'll probably enjoy it on some level, but...
Yeah, are we gonna race a rocket ship? Let's go, baby!
Well, you gotta save some stuff for Fast and Furious 9, man.
That's fair.
This is the, you know, the female spinoff, so this will be... I'm sure Michelle Rodriguez will be out. Like, it would be insane if Michelle Rodriguez was not in this movie. Maybe Jordana Brewster could be in this.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be into that. She's been kind of sidelined in the last couple of Fast and Furiouses.
Wasn't Gal Gadot in one of them?
She, right? Yeah, but her character died, and I was thinking that, like, I mean, they've brought characters back to life in the past. They could bring back Gal Gadot, but, like, she might be busy making Wonder Woman movies.
I don't know. Sounds like you'd have time for Fast 8.2 or whatever the hell it would be. 8.5.
Or they could bring back Charlize Theron and turn her into a good guy, because that's kind of what they do in these movies.
Yeah.
I don't know. Nick, are you a fan of the Fast and Furiouses? The Fast and Furii?
I did a marathon of the first five at one point before the sixth one came out, and I never saw the sixth one or any of them after that. So you'd call me a real fan. But yeah, this news story means almost nothing to me, but I'm happy both of you are enjoying yourselves.
That's good. Yeah, all right, fair enough. So that's the Fast and Furious news. I got one more bit of film news here before we move on to discussions, and that is the fact that Edgar Wright has set his next film, guys. And Edgar Wright, one of my favorite filmmakers, and I know you guys are both big Edgar Wright fans as well. And he's, much like with Baby Driver, he kind of moved into more pure action filmmaking. This time, he's moving into pure horror. His next will be a London-set horror movie, inspired by movies like Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now and Roman Polanski's Repulsion. And I have not seen Don't Look Now. I have seen Repulsion. Repulsion's really good. And the idea of Edgar Wright doing his own version of Repulsion is very fucking exciting. To me, I picture him making a feature-length version of his fake trailer from Grindhouse. Don't. If you're thinking about going in the house,
don't.
If you are thinking of going into this house, don't. If you are thinking of opening this door, don't. If you are thinking of checking out the basement, don't. 2 hours of that, I'm in.
Let's do it.
But yeah, you guys are down for an Edgar Wright horror jam, I assume?
Yeah, I just rewatched Shaun of the Dead this weekend, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Just like on a whim, yeah. So he's basically already done. I mean, obviously, Shaun of the Dead is comedy, but he's got horror stuff.
The beginning
of Hot Fuzz is very thriller, you know, murder mystery stuff. Like, I'm in. This is going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure, like, you know, it's meant to be more of a horror film, but, like, it's still Edgar Wright, so I feel like it's still going to be kind of funny. Like,
it's going to be comedic relief.
Yeah, I just don't picture, like, I remember with Baby Driver, like, it was an action movie, but also there was, like, a lot of really funny stuff happening in Baby Driver. So it's, I'm sure there'll be, like, you know, I'm not saying, like, Simon Pegg will show up to do a couple of yuck-yucks or whatever, but, like...
he's gonna try to jump over a fence.
I wouldn't be mad about it, but,
like... Me neither.
But yeah, Nick, you're into this too, I assume?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Don't Look Now, and I know specifically he's mentioned how, like, the way they use editing in that movie really inspired how he, like, sets up all of his shots and the way he edits his movies, so if that's the sort of inspiration he took out of it, I'm sure he could do something very interesting in horror. And like you said, Mike, he's done Shaun of the Dead, which when I first saw that when I was like 8 or 9, that scared me a lot. So it he did it in my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. So yeah, we're all very excited about that. And I think that about wraps up our film news segment today. Let's move on into our discussions starting right now.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here in Film Bookcast. Nick, we'll start with you, man, since you are the guest. What do you have to discuss with us today?
Well, first off, I have the aforementioned movie Vice, nominated for Best Picture for some strange reason.
Nominated for several Oscars, by the way. It's not just Best Picture. It's Best Director. Christian Bale got Best Actor. Amy Adams, Best Supporting Actress. Sam Rockwell got Best Supporting Actor. And I love Sam Rockwell, but, like, come on, guys.
I like, if they just give Christian Bale an Oscar for being fat, like, I feel like that takes away from people like me who are just fat to begin with. So he's taking that away from us. The best editing thing is actually laughable, because half of this movie feels like a montage parody where it's like fierce like a lion, and then it will cut to a video of a lion. It's like, okay, well, that's that's really not clever, and I don't really get why you did that, but okay, Adam McKay. And the whole movie is just kind of messy in that sense, where there's a lot of interesting aspects to it. I know previously you mentioned, I think on like 2 weeks ago, where they just cut to credits in the middle of the movie, and I thought that was very interesting and very different, but you can't just throw these jokes into a movie that's half made up and then expect people to take it seriously. At least in my opinion, apparently the Academy took it very seriously. but yeah, the whole movie was just kind of like a complete mess as to what it was even trying to say. And yeah, we all really didn't like the Bush administration, but you're kind of a little late to the party. Yeah. It felt like a sole successor to like the Oliver Stone movie W, but with a lot less interesting characters and casting choices and just all around strange. So,
but 10 years.
Yeah, late. Exactly. So yeah, we were all thinking about Bush right now, right?
It seems like it's trying to relate the Bush administration to the current day. It does reference stuff to like it doesn't really like call out Trump by name until the very end, but it alludes to some stuff that like. You know, there's like one moment in the movie where like somebody references that like the president can like decree emergency powers whenever, and then they, like kind of turn to the camera and be like, any sitting president can do that, and
it's weird that you said the words make reference to when they actually just point the camera at it and say, this is what we're doing, this is what we're doing. So I feel like if it was a bit more subtle, it would be more palatable. But the movie just kind of felt like it was yelling at me, and I don't know what I did. So.
Yeah, and I think there is that mid-credit scene that really makes it that much worse. I was explaining to Mike what the credit scene was off the air last week, and it's bad. It's real bad.
Yeah, way to leave a sour taste in the viewer's mouth. Like as soon as they're getting out, like I was like, okay, I can live. Life goes on, and then for some reason, this is still here in this movie. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, it feels like it's blaming me for the Bush administration, and it's like I was 13 at the time, man. Like.
I could not vote, and I would not have voted that way anyway, so...
Yeah.
maybe the movie's just not for me. But yeah, other than that, I was going through... that was the second-to-last Best Picture-nominated movie that I had seen.
It was the Best Pisser. It's the Best Pisser.
Full piss. the other one was Roma, which I watched in the sanctity of my own home. I turned off all the lights, I turned off my phone, and tried to get as theatrical as possible, and I even followed Alfonso Cuarón's, like, settings to turn your TV to get the best experience out of it, and it worked, man. Like, I thought that movie was great.
Nice.
Kind of depressing, but in, like, sort of an uplifting way in the end, and just the way everything's shot, it just feels magical, and very immersive in just the way that he makes the city look. And it feels like, I don't know, it's that cliche of, like, New York City is the third character in Manhattan. It kind of feels that way with Mexico. So, to avoid cliches, it's stuff like that. And just a lot of references to his previous movies, which I think you had said a couple weeks ago. And just, it really feels like he was making a movie that fits all the qualifications of Best Picture without ever pandering towards anything. It still felt like it was his true and absolute vision. And I was just all around a huge fan of it. And aside from, I don't know, maybe A Star Is Born, this should absolutely win Best Picture, but I can understand why it wouldn't.
Right.
So, Roma's fun. Not really, but it's a very good movie.
Yes, I was also a big fan of Roma. Mike, you haven't seen it yet, right?
No, I guess I'm just lazy. But I really want to.
It's literally on your laptop right now.
Yeah, they put it in your house. You're the only one not taking advantage of it.
Yeah. Remember when we all got mad about that free U2 album? And now we're just like, yeah, give me more free stuff, please.
Yeah, yeah, that was a weird time. Why were we so upset about that?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Anyway, yeah, so that's Roma. I do think it could win Best Picture, like I said that before. It is like an uphill battle because no foreign film has ever won Best Picture in the past. So this would be the first time it ever happened. But I think if any movie could do that, I think it's probably Roma. It's that good. And Nick, you said you had one more thing you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, this one's a little strange, and emphasis on little, because the movie that I watched was 1998's Joe Dante directed Small Soldiers.
Hi, I'm Phil Fimple. I'm here to negotiate the surrender of the Gorgonzolas. Now here's our proposal.
Hey!
Take
them! He's selling us down the river! The guy's a regular Arnold Benedict!
I mean... Switch them off, take them apart, steal their batteries, whatever it is you people do. Hey. Is that my JVC?
There will be no surrender. There will be no mercy. The organized scum must die.
Yeah! Bomb them all the way back to preschool.
Recon S-based organized scum strength at 16.
16? Where'd they get 16 from?
7 Gorgonites and 9 people.
Hell yeah!
Wait, that movie is amazing.
Is it? Because last time I watched it, I was 4, and all I remember were, oh, I really want these toys. And then I watched it again as an adult, and I was just baffled that this was the guy who made Piranha and Gremlins and all these other movies that I absolutely love. And this is just so tone deaf. Like, children are almost murdered constantly, but it doesn't feel fun or whimsical. Like, I just feel sad. So if you want a montage of just, like, corn cob skewers going into kids' legs and people just getting cut open. There's also, it was the reunion of, not the Dirty Dozen, but it was some other strange movie from the 60s. They were like, we brought back all the actors. We got Ernest Borgnine. We got, I don't even remember.
The Wild Bunch, isn't it? Is it the Wild Bunch? It might be the Dirty Dozen.
It might be the Dirty Dozen.
Escape. It's. I feel the Dirty Dozen sounds right.
Whatever Ernest Borgnine was in. But yeah.
Is it like Hogan's Heroes or something like that?
No, it's a movie. It's a movie. They're the ones who voice the Commandos, right?
Yeah. So that happens for some reason. They got Tommy Lee Jones to voice a major, and I thought the most interesting part of that was if you stay post the movie, there's a little behind the scenes thing where they're interviewing all the actors who are in the movie, and then it cuts to an action figure in a chair, and it's Tommy Lee Jones voicing him about, like, how his character did everything and how he got his own trailer. So that's probably the most exciting part of Small Soldiers. Other than that, it's kind of like a retelling of, like, Batteries Not Included and, like, a little bit like Gremlins, but with none of the charm and all of the quirks and weirdness that people look back and say, oh, maybe it wasn't that great. But I don't think anyone thought Small Soldiers was great to begin with.
8-year-old me would like to disagree.
Okay.
Yes, and current me would also like to disagree.
23-year-old me says maybe go back and watch the movie again because it's not that great.
I mean, it's been a few years since I've seen it. I saw it again in college at some point. Maybe I don't know. I still enjoyed it at the time. But I'm a huge Joe Dante fan, and yeah, like I love Gremlins 2, and I feel like Small Soldiers definitely not as good as those movies, but it maintains that same sense of anarchy that I love from Joe Dante, which I really appreciate. And it was Small Soldiers was actually the very first PG-13 movie I ever watched. That's it has that place in my heart. In the same way that Mike, I think yours was like The Lost World or something.
Jurassic Park 2.
And you're a nonstop Lost World apologist. I think Small Soldiers.
That's right.
Small Soldiers might be that movie for me, where it's just like, yeah, I can really get into Small Soldiers. Also got Kirsten Dunst at a very young age, right there in that movie, right?
She's not that young, which is also kind of weird because the lead actor is probably 13 or 14, and she was like 18, but still.
Oh, they have like a romantic relationship.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
They like each other.
Like, right? I think she's supposed to be playing like a middle schooler, but this is like 2 years before Spider-Man started shooting. So it's like, why is this adult making out with this child?
Right.
So, yeah, I'm happy I'm not broken like you guys who think Lost World and Small Soldiers are great. But that's my review of Small Soldiers.
All right, fair enough. I gotta watch. That made me want to watch Small Soldiers again, actually. So I feel like this backfired on you spectacularly. anyway, I'm gonna get into my discussions now. I got a few things I wanted to talk about. First of all, we really don't talk about video games that much in this podcast anymore. And I want to start expanding the discussion. Like, we always say discussions is like, you know, whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and it's always movies and TV. And, like, that makes sense, because this is a movies and TV podcast. But I want to try to expand it as much as I can, you know, because we experience a lot of different kinds of media in our day-to-day lives. So I wanted to talk about the Spider-Man video game that came out on the PS4. I believe it came out in, like, September. I finally got it over the Christmas break, and I basically played it nonstop for the last month. It's fucking awesome. It's so good. I know, Mike, you played this game, I know, right?
Yes. Yeah, I beat the main game, and I have beat one of the DLC. You know, they added some characters, new story stuff.
Yeah, Nick, did you play the Spider-Man game?
I am a staunch Microsoft and Xbox person. Ah. So, and by that I mean I refused to watch any gameplay because I knew I would buy a PS4. So I'm in the dark with this one.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, this is the new Spider-Man game developed by Insomniac, and I've been a huge Insomniac fan since I was a kid. They made Ratchet & Clank, they made the Resistance games, and this is basically just an open-world superhero game in the same vein as the Batman Arkham games. Down to, like, the combat, like, it's very similar, just the exploration is very similar, but you're playing Spider-Man, and so it's better.
just by that fact.
Just by that very nature. I mean, Spider-Man is my favorite superhero, so I'm a little biased in that regard. But, you know, there's not much I can say about this game that hasn't already been said. Like, this is one of the most acclaimed games of 2018. I will say it almost never happens where I will 100% an open-world game. But I did for this one. Like, and that wasn't even, like, intentional. It was just, like, I was having so much fun just swinging around the city, stopping crimes or doing these various different side missions that by the time I beat the game, I was already almost at 100% with all the side stuff. So I was like, well, I might as well just, you know, swing around and do that stuff, so I did. It's just a blast. I mean, it gives you its own version of Spidey and his world, while being very true to what makes those characters and that world work so well. And it, you know, has so much, like, references to different things in Spider-Man lore. There's a great callback to Spider-Man 2 in the game, which is just fantastic. So, yeah, I think it's just an amazing time to be a Spider-Man fan right now, because you have a very good Spider-Man with Tom Holland, you have Into the Spider-Verse, and you have the Spider-Man game. Plus, you know, there are, like, some comics or whatever. So yeah, a lot of great Spider-Man stuff out right now. The PS4 game is pretty fantastic, and I have not played that DLC yet. I know there's 3 chapters of the DLC, right, Mike?
Yeah. Yeah, each one focuses on a new character. The first one is Black Cat, and it's really cool. So definitely recommend. It's one of the few times I will ever recommend a DLC for any video game.
Okay, that is a ringing endorsement, because I very rarely download DLC for video games. And I will be getting that after I play Kingdom Hearts 3, because that just arrived at my doorstep today, and I genuinely do not believe that this game actually exists.
I can't believe you're here instead of playing it.
It took a lot of willpower to not cancel the podcast tonight so that I could play Kingdom Hearts. But yeah, so very excited about that, too, and I'll probably talk about that in my discussions at a later date when I actually play the game. And I have a couple other movies I want to talk about, too, some new releases that just came out. First off is The Kid Who Would Be King.
I bet it's a prank. A YouTube thing. A social experiment. Maybe there were hidden cameras. Look. There's something written on the card. Put it into Google Translate. Gladius. Arturi. Filius. Tintagelli. It's Latin. It means Sword of Arthur. Son of Tintagel. Who's Tintagel? It's a place. An island off the coast of Cornwall. Some people say it's where King Arthur was born. Alex, what if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out? What if it's the sword in the stone?
Which is the new movie from director Joe Cornish, the director of Attack the Block. And I've been waiting so long for Joe Cornish to make another movie, guys. It's been 8 years since Attack the Block came out. Hasn't made anything since. I mean, his name is on the credits of, like, writing Ant-Man, because he and Edgar Wright were writing that movie. And he and Edgar Wright also co-wrote The Adventures of Tintin. But, like, it's been a long time since a Joe Cornish movie has come out in theaters. So I was very excited about this. And this is a children's fantasy movie about a kid who discovers that he's a descendant of King Arthur and has to stop the evil Morgana from taking over Britain. And it's a fun time. You know, solid adventure fun. It's nowhere near as good as Attack the Block, but it's also a very different kind of movie. I think it's the kind of movie that if I saw when I was, like, 10 years old, I would have been all fucking about it. Like, this, it is that, like, you know, just kids on adventure. Like, they have to rally the school together, do makeshift things. There's a little bit of Army of Darkness in here. It was you know, solid adventure fun. Also, Rebecca Ferguson is the villain of this movie, and she is having a blast. You know, it's that kind of, like, hissing type, like, snake kind of villain character. She's basically playing Voldemort, but it's Rebecca Ferguson, so it's just weird, because, like, I mostly know her from Mission Impossible, where she's very stoic in those movies, and in this one she's, like, really letting loose, so that was pretty cool. Also really enjoyed this movie's version of Merlin, which there's basically 2 different versions of Merlin. There's, like, a young version, but, like, he occasionally reverts back into his old man form. The old man form is played by a crazy-haired Patrick Stewart wearing an oversized Led Zeppelin t-shirt.
So just Patrick Stewart with a wig.
Yeah. Pretty much. And he's just, you know, making crazy, like, hand motions to do magic spells and stuff. That was a blast. Also, the movie has, like, surprisingly anti-Brexit overtones, and I was all about that. Like, it was like, it's not like, it's not, like, overpowering the movie, but, like, it's the reason everything happens in the movie is because Britain is so divided at this point in time that Morgana can take over, you know, and it's all like they never say the word Brexit or anything, but it's, like, referencing it. And it's just good to see Joe Cornish back in action again. Like, he's a very good director. The action scenes are a lot of fun. I just hope it's not 8 years until his next movie.
Is Joe Cornish the one that made the Quantum of Boris or whatever video?
Yes, he is. And, you know, as good as this movie is, and as good as Attack the Block is, nothing will ever top that. The fake theme song that he made for Quantum of Solace is what you're referring to.
Yes.
More pretty than before. No silly games. something of Boris. I forgot what it's called.
Is that what it was?
But yeah, have you guys seen the trailers for The Kid Would Be King or anything like that?
I've seen trailers for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nick, were you planning on seeing this?
Eventually. Like I said, lack of movie pass has basically cut everything in half. I'm also unemployed right now. This movie will wait for a little bit, at least in my eyes. But the most important question, better or worse than Small Soldiers?
If I had seen this movie when I was, you know, very young, around the same time I'd seen Small Soldiers, I think I could give you a better answer on that front.
I think you're dodging the question, but it's appreciated.
Stay tuned for the next episode after Mike has seen Small Soldiers.
Yeah, the next episode will just be a review of Small Soldiers, by the way.
I've been waiting for you to say that for so long.
All right, finally, I have one more movie I want to talk about in my discussions here, guys. And this is a new movie called Serenity, which is not the Firefly movie. By the way, completely different movie called Serenity. It just came out this past weekend. It stars Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway. And have either of you guys followed the kind of uproar about Serenity over the past week or so?
I saw, like, vague Twitter stuff about Anne Hathaway, but, like, I didn't know what it was about, so I don't really know.
Okay.
So no is that answer.
I just knew it was a
Nick,
movie about a boat, and I know absolutely no one who has seen it other than you, so this is going to be opening my eyes to whatever controversy is surrounding it.
It's not a controversy, really, but so I first saw a trailer for this movie back in, like, September or October or something like that. It was a while back, and I'm pretty sure it got delayed to January. But I saw the trailer and I thought, like, oh, this looks pretty fun, like a kind of like noirish type story where Matthew McConaughey plays like a fisherman and Anne Hathaway. The plot of the movie is that Matthew McConaughey plays a fisherman. Anne Hathaway is his ex-wife who comes into the picture and she has an abusive husband, and she pays Matthew McConaughey money to kill her husband. That's the plot of the movie. And, you know, it has these, like, noir overtones. That's what the trailer was selling. And then, like, you know, the week before the movie came out, like, the movie came out on a Friday, on, like, the Wednesday, the reviews started coming in, and every single headline that I saw referenced the fact that Serenity was the most batshit insane movie of 20. Like there were so many reviews that said, like, I can't say what happens in the movie because you would not believe me if I told you. And so I was like, well, I have to see this movie. and I can confirm that Serenity is the most batshit insane movie of 2019. I know we're only in January. There will not be a more insane movie than Serenity. There is a major twist that comes in at around the halfway mark, and I guessed what it was, like 20 minutes in. But when I guessed it in my head, I was like, that can't possibly be the twist, because that would be insane. But it is the twist. and the movie goes all in on that, and I don't think, like, I'm not going to say what it is, because, you know, we're on the air right now, and spoilers and stuff, and I think if you're at all interested in just completely bad, like, this is, like, laughably bad, this movie, and if you're at all interested in just watching something completely insane, I feel like you should go into this, as, like, knowing as little as possible about what's going on. But the movie makes no sense. It is self-serious to the point of parody. Matthew McConaughey gets naked, like, 6 times for no reason in the movie.
Sign me up.
Ticket sold.
and everyone involved in the making of this movie is out of their goddamn minds. If you guys want me to, I will describe to you what happens in the movie off the air, and I don't think you'll believe me. I genuinely do not believe that you'll think that actually happened. But yes, Serenity, absolutely insane. If you are a fan of ill-advised cinema, which I believe is how it's described on Birth Movies Death, they called it that, Serenity is definitely a movie to check out. It's in the same vein of, like, The Book of Henry, I think, would be a recent example of a movie that was... Does that help clear things up?
Yeah, that paints a pretty picture for me. I'm more excited now than I was. So
fair enough. So that is Serenity. It's absolutely insane. Now, Mike, you've got your own discussions to talk about, right?
Yes. The first thing I wanted to talk about is season 3 of True Detective,
okay,
which is currently airing on HBO. Episode 4, I believe, was this past week.
Yes, and I think it's halfway through the season at this point, right?
Yeah, I can't remember if it's 8 or 10.
It's usually 8, I feel like, with True Detective, but...
I hope so. so that might be a little snippet of what I feel so far.
Yeah.
Season 3 is much better than Season 2. Like, you could only go up from Season 2, I feel. and it's such an unfair comparison to ever compare anything to Season 1 of True Detective. I feel
sure.
like that was such a, like, flash in the bottle. at that like moment in TV, like what that did.
Yeah.
You know, like prestige television and all that stuff. But that said, season three so far, I'm enjoying a lot. For the most part, it is much more in line with what I liked about season one. It's dealing with a lot of time issues and memory. You know, it follows the same character played by Mahershala Ali through, like, in 1980, I think, is when the case, the murder, like, the case happens.
Right.
It gets revisited in 1990, and then I think present 2015 or whatever. I forget what they say the year. Like, old
yeah,
man.
Yeah, I think it's 2015 with the old man Mahershala.
Yeah. all these memories coming back, and he has, I think, Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's dealing with a lot of that stuff. And it's doing some pretty interesting things, I think, regarding that theme. And it's dealing with, you know, noir tropes and all this stuff. And Stephen Dorff, like, who I can't believe is, like, killing it as his partner in this season. I really enjoy their relationship.
Yeah.
But my biggest gripe so far I've had with the show this
sure.
season is it will do a lot of this, you know, characters will mention and be like, well, remember what happened in like, 90 when we reopened the case? And the other character will be like, yeah. And then they just move on. And it's like, you're not building a mystery. You're just deliberately withholding information from the audience.
Right.
And, I can't tell, like, it makes me annoyed when they do that, because, like, clearly you're building to something.
Yeah.
But it's not, like, there's no tension there other than you told me you're not telling me something. And it's like, you know what I mean? I don't know if either of you guys are watching it or feel that way.
I've been watching it, yeah. I've watched the first three episodes. The first two, by the way, are directed by Jeremy Saulnier, so they are worth
yes.
checking out for that reason. And I am definitely enjoying it more than season two. I do have, like, it's... It feels like, I don't know, True Detective Season 1 was a very good season. And I feel like since then they've been trying to capture the magic of Season 1, but, like, it's, I don't know, that was just, like, a one-time thing, like you were saying. And so a lot of it just seems like, you know, macho posturing for the sake of macho posturing, or, like, tough guy dialogue that doesn't really mean anything to me. To me, True Detective is, like, the show that I watch when I want to scroll Twitter for an hour, but, like, have something on in the background at this point.
Wow. Savage.
So, like, I kind of enjoy it. I think the cinematography is very good. I think Mahershala Ali is doing a very good
yeah.
performance in the show. But it just feels kind of, like, meaningless to me, I guess. So, I know... And I went to go watch episode 4 on Sunday night. And I saw that it was, like, 15 minutes longer than the usual episode. And I was like, no. I'm not going to do it. I can't do that tonight.
Wow.
So, I don't think I even ended up watching anything. I was just...
I was just stared at it. The TV was off.
I just turned off the TV and went to bed, I think. I was like, fuck it. It's completely put me in a bad mood. just the idea of watching 15 extra minutes of True Detective.
How dare you.
But yeah, so, I mean, season 3 is definitely better than season 2, like, and I'm
yeah.
enjoying parts of it, but yeah, it's not really working for me all that well.
Yeah, and I don't come down as hard on it as you do,
okay.
but, like, I've just have noticed that they're doing that a lot, where it's like, oh, man... One day we're going to tell you what happened. Like, okay. That's not, like, mysterious or tense.
Right.
But, so I do hope it is only 8 episodes, because I do also feel in episode 4 there was a lot of, like, slow filler stuff happening. And I'm hoping that if it's only 8 episodes, they got to start getting to the point eventually, right?
Theoretically.
Theoretically, yeah. So, I mean, for the most part, I'm sure I'll check in after the season's over, like we always do with these HBO shows.
Right.
So, stay tuned, I guess, for my final thoughts on True Detective. And the other thing I'd like to discuss is M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, you finally watched Unbreakable 2 years after watching Split.
Yeah.
you were like, yeah, I guess I'll get around to this now.
You're a little late.
Yeah. 2 days before seeing Glass, 2 years after Split. It all worked out.
The perfect time. So, what'd yes. you think, man? I mean, this is a lot of people consider this M. Night Shyamalan's best movie.
Interesting. No. No.
That didn't sound
I actually, yeah, I didn't mean... That was for jokes.
Sure.
For the most part, I really liked Unbreakable. I think it is weird to watch it in 2019.
I would agree with
know,
that, yeah.
That's fair.
Post the superhero comic book boom, movie
yeah.
boom. So it's interesting to see, because when this came out in what, 2000 or
yeah
90?
2000.
Yeah.
So that was like right after Batman and Robin had basically killed everything off for superhero movies. So just remember
pretty
that.
Much yeah.
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 So but that's what I didn't like look and contextualize, you know, when X-Men and Spider-Man.
Well, X-Men came out that same year, 2000. Yeah. So it was like around
wow.
that same time. So Unbreakable was like kind of the grounded alternative to some of the stuff that was going to be coming out.
Yeah. So and it definitely feels that way, but it has this weird thing that I feel will come up later, where it's like, we're just going to tell you the trope kind of stuff, because none of this had been done yet, really, as far as movies.
Right.
I guess other than the Batman movies. But I think Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson are, like, amazing in this movie. I think the kind of mystery story stuff was really cool.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. You know, I'm not as big an aficionado as Shyamalan's movies as you are, Mike. But I feel like...
I was going to say, I never even, like, considered myself an aficionado of Night Shyamalan's movies. And then, like, I was looking back at the filmography after I saw Glass, and I was like, oh, I've seen most of these.
Yeah.
I've seen almost all of... I think the only one I haven't seen of the stuff post-Sixth Sense is Lady in the Water. That's the only one that I haven't actually watched. Wow. The rest of them I've seen.
But, yeah, I was surprised at how close to the end the twist happens. I don't really I don't know if that's always how it happens, where it's like, oh, here's the last 2.5 minutes, we're gonna do a
right.
twist. and I don't know if it's just through cultural osmosis that, like, I knew what the story was.
Yeah.
That this didn't feel like as massive a twist as some of his other movies were at the time. Maybe, I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, I think partially it's the twist. I mean, the twist at the end of Unbreakable, I guess, is that, I mean, I'm assuming is what you're referring to, is that Samuel L. Jackson's the one who
right, yeah.
Organized
it's
the train
revealed.
Crash. But, like, the metatextual twist is that this movie has been a secret superhero movie this whole time, and you didn't even realize it, kind of thing. Like, you did, because you knew going into it that it's sort of about superheroes. But, like, at the time, in the year 2000, like, nobody really knew about that. Like, it was being sold as, like, a thriller. Didn't have, like, it was just Bruce Willis, Samuel L. Jackson. Like, you know, when the movie starts and that thing comes up explaining what comic books are, like, everybody's like, what?
Like, yeah, I forgot about that. That was really weird.
Yeah.
I mean, like, interesting, like, in a way that this movie has to establish that comic books are, like, a thing.
Right.
That movies can be based on, sort of. Yeah, I mean, but for the most part, it was really cool. It's interesting. It's an interesting movie, like, historically, I feel like. Just in the way Hollywood went. This movie did it first, and it did it in a original, air quotes, kind of way. Like, the story is original, but I feel like maybe the concept's not. I don't really know how to handle that. But, yeah, that's Unbreakable.
Cool, yeah. And I wanted to rewatch Unbreakable before I saw Glass. Didn't get the chance to. Nick, did you get the chance to rewatch Unbreakable?
Yeah, I watched that and Split back-to-back just in case I missed something. Like I said, I'm unemployed. I got a lot of free time, so. But, yeah, I love Unbreakable so much. Like, it's probably my second favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie because, you know, Signs is like skyscrapers
Signs
staring down.
Number one.
Of course it is.
Oh, boy.
Hey.
Man, that is a... I am not the hugest fan of Signs, I will say that.
I can leave now if you want. but yeah, I still think it works pretty well for me, and I love that there's almost no action in the movie except for, like, an hour and 40 minutes in, and even that action is kind of shot very strangely, and a lot of it's off-camera, and it only lasts for about 5 minutes anyway. So I think it was a very unique way of handling it, and I still look back fondly with it. But I can understand, after you've seen 20 Marvel movies, why this movie is a little bit strange.
Yeah, and it was interesting, too, like, to think about how massive Marvel has become, and just comic books and comic book movies and the structure that this movie was able to hide. Unbreakable was able to hide all that for like an hour and 40 minutes or whatever you said,
because
people hadn't really ever seen it before. But now it's like, clearly this is a superhero movie, like like having seen it post 20 movies of superheroes.
20 years of superhero movies later, it's a different ballgame. But, yeah, so that is Unbreakable, which, of course, led to Split 17 years later. And we should just kind of briefly discuss Split, I guess, before we get into our featured review. We talked about Split 2 years ago when it came out. Pretty good movie, I think. You know, it's a pretty fun, like, horror movie that reveals itself at the end to be in the same universe as Unbreakable, and thus also a secret superhero movie in its own way. And so that's what I like about the twist at the end of, like, the idea of Unbreakable being a secret superhero movie. Split does the exact same thing.
It's interesting to use a different genre, right, for Split. Like, we're going to do straight horror, basically like a weird psychological horror movie.
Yeah.
And then, twist, it's a supervillain origin story, which is what I missed, having not seen Unbreakable.
Right. But yeah, Nick, what's your take on Split? Just because you weren't on that episode when we reviewed it.
Well, I also already knew about, like, the tie-in, too, so I feel like that took a little bit out of Split for me, where the whole time
really?
I knew that this was going to happen. I also purposely avoided listening to your episode on it, because I heard there was a twist, and then I got it spoiled for me on Twitter anyway.
Damn.
But I think it's a fine movie. I think James McAvoy is phenomenal in that, and it carries through to Glass, but, I like it because it does similar things to Unbreakable, but it doesn't follow the same storyline at all, really. Like you said, it's more like a psychological
right.
horror, and parts of it feel like Silence of the Lambs, like when he's just dancing in front of the girls in, like, a basement, like, it's kind of creepy. But it's effective in what it does, and just the way that they tied it together, it didn't feel forced, so I'm happy with it.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. So that's Unbreakable, that's Split, and now let's move on into our featured review of Glass.
The three of you've convinced yourselves you have extraordinary gifts, like something out of a comic book. David Dunn, the only person to survive that train wreck all those years ago.
What do you do?
I'm in security.
You think you have superpowers?
It's a feeling. Vision. I have to touch them.
You believe you are a protector.
My name is Patricia.
I have no question. There are 24 identities.
I'm Mary Reynolds.
Por favor, señora.
We almost got you, bro.
That live in that body with you.
The beast is coming any minute now for you guys.
But what I am questioning is your belief that you are something more than human.
And yet, it is true.
All right, that was from the trailer for Glass, the new movie written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. It stars Bruce Willis, James McAvoy, Samuel L. Jackson, Sarah Paulson, Anya Taylor-Joy, Spencer Tree Clark, and Charlene Woodard, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Glass reads, security guard David Dunn uses his supernatural abilities to track Kevin Wendell Crumb, a disturbed man who has 24 personalities. So like we were saying, guys, Unbreakable, I think we all agree, is a very good movie. Split is a pretty good movie with what I think is a great twist ending. Like, recounting the idea that, like, you know, I was in the theater alone watching Split, I was pretty much the only one who realized what was happening as it was happening. Because it's a weird twist when you think about it. It's one that you need, like, outside knowledge of a 17-year-old movie at that point to understand. And I think most people, like, most moviegoers were going because they were like, oh, James McAvoy in a horror movie, let's go see this. Not really paying attention to the overall oeuvre of M. Night Shyamalan.
The mise en scène.
Yeah, exactly. So when that, yeah, that's an incorrect usage of mise en scène, but... when that happened, you know, I remember that twist happening. I remember the Unbreakable theme song, like the theme, James Newton Howard score kicking in. And I was like, this sounds really familiar. Is this from Unbreakable? And then the camera's panning over and you hear somebody say, like, oh, whatever happened to that guy in the wheelchair? And then it cuts over to Bruce Willis and he's like, oh, you mean Mr. Glass? And it's like, oh, bum, bum, shit. Bum. And you cut to me freaking out in the theater by myself.
It's a live feed.
Yeah, while everyone else is just kind of like wandering around like, all right, and they're shuffling out of the theater. I'm like stuck in my chair like, what just happened? So yeah, I thought that was a great twist ending and, you know, a very cool shout out to Unbreakable fans. But nobody really knew what was going to happen right after that. And then a few months later, Shyamalan announced that Glass was officially in the works, got pretty much the entire original cast back from Unbreakable, and he got some of the characters from Split back, and he put them together, he mashed them together into one movie. And I was pretty excited for this because, you know, M. Night was kind of on a hot streak. You know, he had The Visit, which is a movie that I like. I don't know if you've seen that, Nick. Have you seen The Visit?
That, again, is part of the skipping every M. Night Shyamalan movie until I hear it's amazing. And you're the only person I know who said it was amazing.
The Visit is really solid. Mike's not a fan, but okay. The Visit is really solid. And that was the first indication where, you know, it's M. Night doing, like, you know, that was right after After Earth, which is a movie I hated. I hated After Earth. But he comes back with The Visit, this, you know, very low-budget, like, $5 million found footage horror movie from Blumhouse. And he ended up doing a pretty good job with it. And then, you know, he came out with Split 2 years later. Same deal, you know, low-budget Blumhouse movie. And, you know, it seemed like once he kind of... Like, Shyamalan's problem, you know, from the beginning of his career, he became so big so fast, you know, with movies like The Sixth Sense and then Signs, like, everybody was, like, you know, all aboard the Shyamalan train, and then it took a long time. Like, he kept making movies that were terrible, and it's, like, a lot of the reason for that was because of his own ego and, like, that nobody was telling him no because he was too big. You know, it was the George Lucas prequels thing. It's like, you know, nobody's going to tell George Lucas you can't do this in Star Wars because he's George Lucas. He should know everything about Star Wars, right? And it was sort of the same deal with the M. Night Shyamalan movies. That's why you got movies like The Happening, which is, like, one of the worst movies I've ever seen. That's a movie on the level of Serenity in terms of, like, its absolute insanity.
Wow.
I know I keep bringing up... You guys really got to watch Serenity at some point.
Okay.
But The Happening is crazy, and, you know, then there was, by the time, I've told the story in the podcast before, but by the time The Last Airbender came out, like, Shyamalan's name was a joke, because at that point it was a streak of, like, The Village, and Lady in the Water, and The Happening, and then The Last Airbender, which was, like, the last straw, and then I remember, like, a couple months later, I went to the midnight show for Inception, and at the midnight show for Inception, they showed a trailer for the movie Devil, which is a movie that M. Night Shyamalan produced, and in the trailer for the movie Devil, everything goes quiet for a second. It's, like, loud and everything. Like, everybody's, like, and, like, it's a kind of intense trailer. And then everything goes quiet, and the text reads on the screen, "From the mind of M. Night Shyamalan." And everyone in my theater laughed. Just laughed hysterically at the very notion that M. Night Shyamalan was still producing movies. You know? And it wasn't just that time. Every time I saw the trailer for Devil, people in the theater would laugh at it because it was M. Night Shyamalan. And, you know, then there was After Earth, but then he started to kind of slowly build the comeback. And then Glass seemed like it was going to be, like, the victory lap for M. Night Shyamalan, right? Like, he got two pretty solid movies. He's going back to his Unbreakable well. He's, like, delivering the sequel that fans have wanted to see for many years. And then the reviews came out, and they were not the glowing reviews that I was hoping Glass was going to get. I believe it sits somewhere like a 30-something on Rotten Tomatoes right now. It was very divisive. It definitely has its fans. It's definitely not the movie that I think people who wanted a sequel to Unbreakable were expecting or necessarily wanted. So I'm very curious what you guys thought of Glass. Because, you know, Mike, you just watched Unbreakable 2 days ago. And Nick, I mean, I'm assuming you had seen Unbreakable before you had watched it recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you've been a fan of Unbreakable for a while. So, Nick, we'll start with you. What are your overall thoughts on Glass?
That was most of a good movie. Going back to the Unbreakable thing, I love that basically after, like, the first 5 minutes of action and basically it's like a big overview of what happened. Like, it's just quiet, contemplative, like, people sitting in an asylum for 2 hours, which is... That's prime Nick. So I just... That's what I want out of my superhero movies, is people just sitting and talking to each other. And I thought that that part worked really well with Unbreakable. But
it couldn't be more Nick if Paddington was in it, I believe. It's,
do not... I'm already working on my fan fiction. Please don't step on my feet. And then, because he's M. Night Shyamalan, he just couldn't do it all the way. And I feel like that's similar to the ending of Vice, which left a big sour taste in my mouth. This one was so much of a build-up, and then it just kind of petered off in the end. So, all in all, I was very happy with it for the most part. And, well, it's very hard to talk about anything without going into spoilers, so I guess I'll save that part till a little later.
Sure, definitely. Now, Mike, what about you? What did you think of Glass overall, as somebody who is very new to the Unbreakable verse?
Yes. I, for the most part, agree with Nick. I think this is mostly pretty good. It is absolutely insane. Like, I can't believe this is a thing. It's definitely one of the most, like, ambitious films I've seen in a long time, especially coupling it with a 20-year-old sequel, or 17, or whatever the hell, you know what I mean. like, out of nowhere, we're gonna build this cinematic universe out of these three movies, half in secret, right? You know, so all of a sudden, oh shit, it's happening after Split. So I definitely, like, commend it for that, and the way it uses Unbreakable a lot, mostly a little bit of Split. Like, you know, revisiting a lot of the movie itself. And I thought that was really interesting and creative and makes me wonder, like, was he planning this the whole time? Like, how did you manage to pull this shit off? which is, like, really cool. But there's a lot of stuff where it's like, all right, sure. You know what I mean? Like, there's just moments where, like, okay. But for the most part, I was pretty into it. But I still can't really understand my feelings about this movie. I feel like some of it really annoys me and some of it really impresses me. So I embody these divisive reviews all in one person.
You are every side of the reviews from every angle.
Yes.
Yeah, I think Glass is definitely weaker than both of the previous films. And by some metrics, I can even say I didn't like long stretches of the movie. But at the same time, like, M. Night goes for it, man. Like, it's like I just have to kind of respect the audacity of this movie. It very deliberately denies audiences the thing they seem to want out of this movie. And in doing so, I think it must have been such an a weird task to try to make a movie that acts as both a sequel to Unbreakable and a sequel to Split, because they are very different movies. And I think Glass does about as good a job as possible with that. I think for a long stretch, it is like the grounded story in the mold of Unbreakable. But at the same time, the movie goes bug nuts crazy in a vein similar to Split. Yeah. Although it goes much further than Split ever did in terms of craziness. Like, Split is a pretty standard horror movie. And this is... again, we'll talk about a lot of that stuff in the spoilers, but, like, there's some shit that happens that's, like, what is going on here in this movie? But it feels to me like it's three movies kind of, like, rolled into one, you know? Kind of split up by act breaks. Like, I can split up the different movies as they happen. Like, the first act with David Dunn hunting Kevin Crumb, that feels like the movie that people wanted Glass to be. Right, that's what everybody was like, okay, they're doing Split with Unbreakable, like David Dunn's gonna be the hero and Kevin Crumb's gonna be the villain, this would be great and everything. And like if that was the full movie, I think this would have gotten glowing reviews. Like, it's quite possible. Yeah. The second act is Sarah Paulson as the therapist, having these three characters in a mental institution, trying to convince them they don't have superpowers. And that feels like it's from a different movie entirely. And I will say, to me, that is the weakest stretch of the movie. I know, Nick, you just said that was your favorite part.
That's fair.
but to me, I don't know, that part was frustrating because we spent two whole movies with these characters. We already know that they have superpowers. So it really felt like it was just kind of killing time for me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you spent so much time trying to act like, well, what if you don't have superpowers? And I'm like, then what was Unbreakable? What was Split? What were we watching before? And I wouldn't put it past M. Night Shyamalan to make it like, there were no superpowers the whole time. But like,
what's the twist?
But like, that would have been, and in a career full of dumb twists, that would have been his dumbest twist. Like, but then you have that climax, right? You have that climax, like that huge climactic sequence. And I think that's where Shyamalan goes absolutely batshit insane. And I was kind of there for it. It is absolutely not what people wanted out of this movie. It's not what I was expecting out of this movie, but it is distinctly 100% uncut Shyamalan. And I was kind of about that.
And you can do that when you fund your own movie. So I think it cost him like $20 million. He put all the money forward himself, and you just do whatever you want. And I think it's still already made like $162 million just in 2 weeks. So
yeah, it did really well.
Good for him, I guess. But.
Yeah, his gamble paid off, and I'm but outside of the actual, like, we'll talk about spoilery stuff in a bit. What did you think of the performances in this movie? James McAvoy, I think, was the highlight for sure. I think he just continues to be incredibly fun to watch as Kevin Crumb. He's cycling through these personalities at a much more rapid pace than I remember happening in Split. And I haven't seen Split since it was in theaters, so maybe Nick, maybe you can fact check me on that. But I don't remember any scenes where it was like, you know, 10 personalities all at once, you know what I mean?
Well, also in Split, they didn't have that weird strobe light thing that was kind of forcing them, so... And right. I feel like the major part of Split was there were, like, the three identities that were in major control, sort of suppressing the other ones from ever coming out, and then the build-up was to the Beast, so this one, those three are no longer absolutely in control, and with the manipulation of the lights and the fact that the Beast can come to power no matter what, they were able to cycle through them faster. I'm not saying it makes sense, and I feel like a lot of it was they sat James McAvoy down in a room and were just like, all right, you did 5 or 6 in the last one, let's get 20. Like, and then when they got to that point, they were like, just a couple more for coverage, we'll see what we can put in the movie.
Just go. Yeah.
And I think that stuff works, though. I think that the acting is probably the best part of the whole movie. It's what really sells it, and specifically James McAvoy and Samuel L. Jackson, because Lord knows Bruce Willis has not acted in about 15 years.
Well, he's just an old sad man.
Yeah,
he's just an old sad. I think it fit his character in this movie, but it did feel like, you know, there was James McAvoy going nuts. You have Samuel L. Jackson chewing the scenery, and then you have Bruce Willis, who's like there,
But David Dunn kind of is that guy, though.
But it,
right.
Is that why he wanted to come back and do this? Because he was just like, okay, I could do the sequel to the one movie where I emoted nothing and just kind of used my arms, and that was it. So
sometimes,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. But yeah, I will agree with you there. I think Samuel L. Jackson is probably also a highlight in this movie, but he is underused. Yes. He really gets into the action around like 70 minutes in. But when he finally gets in there, like, he's a blast. He's a lot of fun to watch. And I like the fact that they did bring in some of the ancillary characters from the other movies. I mean, you have Bruce Willis' son, played by Spencer Tree Clark, which is kind of cool to see him. Like, he's all grown up now, and so that's pretty cool. You also have Anya Taylor-Joy coming back from Split, and I was a little weirded out by what they did with her character in this movie and her relationship with Kevin. I think it ultimately, like, kind of worked in the end, but it's, like, it's real touch and go for a little while, I think.
I think if you view it as, like, Stockholm Syndrome, it makes sense, and, like, the mutual respect of two people being broken. But what is broken? Because that's a very thin line where you could easily offend so many people if you say it wrong. So,
yeah. I will say, I mean, the way they kind of establish their relationship, like, they, at the very end of Split, they make reference to the fact that he lets her go at the end of Split, right? And, you know, she tells him that, like, she actually was able to get her uncle put in jail because of the way he abused her in the past, and she wouldn't have been able to do that if that whole thing with in Split didn't happen. So, like, in a way, they're not, like, friends, but, like, they have, like, a mutual understanding, sort of. And so,
It's definitely framed as, like, a romantic relationship, though.
Well, I don't think it's a... Not on her end. I think it's only...
Is it, though? It seems like it. It's really uncomfortable and weird to me.
I don't know. I don't think I got that out of it. I think, you know, it's on his end, it seemed a little bit like that. I think she was... You know, she But that's also only in, like, one of his 24 personalities, too. But, like,
yeah, that's true.
But, like, on her end, it just seemed like, you know, she was sort of confronting this, like, traumatic thing that happened to her that also sort of helped her in a weird way. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of complexities in everything that's going on with Anya Taylor-Joy's character. And I think she plays it pretty well. It's a very weird arc for that character.
Yes, I agree.
And then also Charlene Woodard is back as Samuel Jackson's mom, who is actually, I believe, like 12 years younger than Samuel L. Jackson in real life.
What?
I believe I read that online, which is... Samuel Jackson looks 70 years old. Like, just...
Damn.
Throwing that out there, which is insane to think about. But anyway, yes. Yeah. So, but she's good in the movie, too, and it is cool to have those characters kind of worked into the movie as, like, kind of the out... Like, every character... Like, all three of our main characters have, like, one kind of support person on the outside. Which I thought, you know, was a good, like, kind of balancing. But, you know, Unbreakable was this sort of, like, groundbreaking movie in 2000. Like, in part because it served to bring these complex tropes and logic to film in a way that was rarely done at that point. You know, like we were saying, like, the movie even has to open up with, like, a thing that explains what comic books are.
And how popular they are. Like, yeah.
And it's like, all right, like I remember watching Unbreakable a couple years ago and being like, man, this seems, like, it's just weird that it has to do that, you know? But now it's 2019. We've gone we as a culture have gone way past that, right? Like, we're all, like, inundated with comic book culture every single day. We know all this stuff, but it feels like M. Night hasn't gone past that with Glass.
Yes.
Like, Glass still feels the need to explain, for example, what a showdown is.
And that's my biggest critique with this movie.
Yeah. Go off on that, Mike.
Like, you don't, it seems sort of similar to what you guys are talking about with Vice, where we're going to stop and turn to the camera and explain the thing.
Right.
We had Marvel Studios exists. You don't need to explain what a limited edition crossover thing is. You don't need to explain, like, the showdown. You don't need to tell me, like, the reluctant hero meets the mastermind, meets the crazy supernatural. Just do it. Just stop wasting my time.
Right.
Pretending these things don't exist in pop culture anymore, like, you know what I mean?
I think if you look at that as, like, kind of like how Scream deconstructed, like, slasher movies, though, because it was just this group of people who was obsessive over this style, and I feel like if you look back at it and be like, well, Sam Jackson's deconstructing it because it's so popular, maybe that's a way of framing it where it makes sense. But I'm a huge M. Night apologist, so you go off. Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly one... It feels like they're trying. I honestly haven't seen Scream in a very long time, so I don't know how effective it would be now or whatever. But it feels like we're not particularly deconstructing it to any effective means. It feels like we're just saying the thing. We're making the subtext text, and it's like, we get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Scream comparison's an interesting one, because I think Scream is a more well-written movie, and thus is able to is able to do that a little bit better. But also, you know, you say like slasher movies had kind of died out at that time when Scream came out. That was sort of the thing, was when Scream came out, it revitalized slasher movies for a little while. Like, that's when you got movies like I Know What You Did Last Summer and stuff like that. Like, right after Scream hit. So, like, you know, Scream is referencing the stuff that, like, these tropes that were well-known at the time, and because of that, like, Scream is able to kind of play off them in interesting ways. This movie, it's not really playing off them in interesting ways, it's just telling you what the tropes are.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're not doing it in any particularly, like, in any clever way. It's always, like, you know, Samuel Jackson's mom will turn around and be like, oh, you know, Elijah talked about the ending of comic books once, and he said this, a showdown is this, and it's
yeah.
It's like, all right, like, yeah, that's dialogue that we did not need in the movie. Like, we already know what a showdown is. Like,
maybe they were in real time actually explaining it to Bruce Willis, who probably has no idea what a comic book movie is. So
that's possible.
That is actually 100% possible. And that is the fan theory that I will go with for the rest of these days. But yeah, ultimately, I think Glass is a severely flawed movie that I sort of really dug for a lot of its runtime. I think it's one of those, like, ambitious messes that, like, swings for the fences. And, you know, I would rather have that than, like, a mediocre Unbreakable sequel, you know? Like, if it was just, I want to talk about some stuff, and we can't really get into spoilers, so I guess we should just do that. unless you guys have anything, any other last thoughts before we move on to the spoilers?
Not really. I think I agree with you that it swings for the fences, and on that level, I do admire how, like, batshit insane and bold this movie is. And, like, it mostly works, I guess.
Yeah. And I feel like I've been mostly positive, and the only reasons I haven't been negative is because everything I hated is in spoilers, so,
okay.
Oh, here we go.
All right, then let's get right into it, man. Let's hear what you hate. It's spoilers for Glass, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Glass, starting right now. So, guys, this movie has not one, not two, but by my count, three patented M. Night Shyamalan twists. all delivered within, like, 10 minutes of each other. Like, it's just, like, one twist after another. So I guess we should just run down the twists one by one, and I'm assuming these twists are the things that Nick hates about this movie.
Oh, you betcha.
Okay. All right, so twist the first. The train that Kevin's father died on was also the train that Mr. Glass derailed in Unbreakable. That's played as a twist, but it's something that everyone had pretty much figured out already by the time Split, like, when Split revealed that it's the Unbreakable universe, right? There's stuff in that movie where it's like, oh, Kevin's dad got killed on a train, like a runaway train. And then once the Unbreakable thing came out, I was like, oh, well, it must have been the train that Mr. Glass derailed. Obviously, why else would you do this? And even, like, before this movie came out, they were calling it, like, the East Rail 177 trilogy. So I was like, well, that's probably going to be the case. And it was.
Has there ever been a more unwieldy name for a trilogy also?
If there is, I can't think of one right now, so there is that. But yeah, so when that twist came to play, like, A, it's kind of delivered in an underwhelming way. It's just like, don't you realize what the truth is? And, like, you know, all right.
Yeah.
So there is that twist. And when that happened, I was like, man, I really hope that's not the only twist in the movie, because that would be kind of underwhelming for M. Night's part. But then, as the movie went on, I was like, maybe I should have just went for that first twist.
We should have stopped.
Maybe that was enough.
I would have been happy with that, but yeah.
So then you get on to twist the second, which is the fact that they were never really in a mental institution this entire time, guys. In fact, Sarah Paulson and her crew are part of a secret organization that works to keep superheroes under wraps. And then, this is the big thing, they kill all three of the main characters. Well, Kevin kills Mr. Glass, but then one of the guys shoots Kevin, and then they drown David in a puddle.
Fucking Chekhov's pothole,
okay.
Man.
That one I'm almost a little bit okay with, because in Unbreakable, he's like, oh, I almost drowned when I was a kid. That doesn't happen to superheroes. Only normal people drown. And then he got drowned. That's the only positive thing I can say about that twist, though.
Okay.
Actually, what the fuck? Like,
I will say, and I dislike this about Unbreakable too. This is something I've always thought was weird about Unbreakable, and I still think it's weird about Glass. I hate that his weakness is drowning, because that's everybody's weakness. Yeah. They make such a big deal about it. Like, oh man, his one weakness is that he can drown. Like, yeah, so can fucking everyone else.
It's not a rock from a faraway alien planet. Yeah. It's drowning, you know.
And he pulls the same shit with Signs. It's always water. M. Night comes back around to water.
Well, does he have some traumatic experience with water in his past?
In 2004, Lady of the Water. As a publicity stunt before The Village was announced, he made a fake, like, sci-fi documentary about it, and then he was talking on the Sci-Fi Channel, not a sci-fi documentary, and he talked about how he always uses water as a symbol because when he was very young, he nearly drowned, and that's why he always does it. The issue is, that was a lie, and then a bunch of people, like, there was a fake investigation about it, and then there was, like, a whole controversy about that, because it was like, why on earth did you even put this out here? So he's, like, it almost made sense, and then it just turns out he's just a crazy person, and water's just the one way out.
Fair enough. That's fair. So all three of the main characters die, and that's part of the second twist. And then the third... is that Sarah Paulson, you know, after they kill them all, thinks they're done, right? They think they've accomplished their job. But it turns out that Mr. Glass was one step ahead of them this whole time. He knew this would happen all along. He sent all the camera footage of the battle to his mom, Anya Taylor-Joy, and David Dunn's kid. How he got the email addresses for those last two remains a mystery. And then those three upload the footage to YouTube, and it starts to go viral, implying the world now knows about super people, and then the movie ends. And that's it. And this all happens within the span of like 10 minutes. I couldn't believe what I was watching in the theater as this was happening. So, we've gone through all the twists. Nick, since you have stated that you have issues with all of these things, take the floor.
All right. So first twist, it's mostly the reasons you've already claimed. It's just super underwhelming. And like, as soon as it happened, I was like, yeah, we all kind of like, we collectively knew that it was the train. So, yeah. Like, I thought it was neat that they merged it into Unbreakable footage, but that twist meant almost nothing. And right. I guess it's just a means for Mr. Glass to get killed. Twist number two, just why? Like, if they had even just had it where, like, oh, we just shot them because they were fighting on the lawn, like, and they're killing people, that's enough. The right. fact that it's, okay, so they're a secret society, and the only way they can meet together is, oh, we all go into a restaurant, and we just wait for everyone else to leave. Like, what a dumb way of getting together. Like, all I can think of is, like, Quantum of Solace, which is not a great movie, but there's one point where all the villains go into an opera and they have earpieces so they can at least communicate, and that makes sense. Right. I just imagine some guy got there at, like, 7:30, and he's just looking at his watch like, Jesus Christ, it's been 3 hours. Can you leave the bar so we can start talking? So it's just, it's such a convoluted way of doing it. And I, like, what are do they have thousands and thousands of people everywhere that are just going out killing these superheroes? Like, how long has this been going on? They said 10,000 years.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Which was ridiculous.
Just limit yourself. Just be like, oh, you're the first people we saw with superpowers. Like, we cut you off. We nipped it at the bud because it would freak people out. That makes more sense. Like, if they right. had it, like,
if they were some kind of government organization or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. Like, or if it was even like,
yeah.
This is weird that I'm bringing this up, but like the email thing in Batman versus Superman, where at least it was like Lex Luthor had emails of these superhumans, but they were just discovered, and that makes sense. So it's like we tracked them down and we're trying to get rid of them. It makes no right. sense that that's some like do they have like ancient scrolls of like these superheroes that they killed Jesus? Like, what is the limit of what they're trying to say? It makes no sense whatsoever.
Like, why would they allow the comic book industry to exist then?
Exactly.
If they're this 10,000-year-old powerful organization.
Like, yeah, they'd right. be posting, like, book burnings for comic books, or they'd get them all shut down. Like, there's no reason that this would have existed for so long. But also, has David Dunn been running around for 20 years, and they finally got him when he fell out of a brick building? And, like, it does, none of it makes any sense. And just the fact that, like, that's the sandwiched in between the two. The other twists are almost forgivable because they're, like, the first one is right. not a twist. And then, I guess, going into the third one, I was pretty okay with that. Except for the fact that they were like, you yeah. know what's the biggest social media hub? The train station. So we'll all meet up there and watch everyone see it on their iPhones. Like, just put it on, like, they were showing that building with, like, the solar panels, and I was like, oh, are they going to project it on the side of the building or something? And no, it's like, right. Oh, we sent it to people's iPads, so, like, a guy getting on the train is like, oh, this is a strong dude, and they fought outside that building down the street.
M. Night must just love that 30th Street station in Philly, because he films there all
the
time.
Or it's cheap. Yeah. Like, they're like, all right, you've been here before, we'll cut the rate in half, you can have the train station.
Yeah, and I love the idea that, like, you know, the idea that footage goes immediately viral, and, like, maybe it would, but, like, you know, if that actually happened, like, say that happened in the real world, and, like, you know, footage of a superhuman battle of the kind that is shot in that video leaked onto the internet, and, like, say we all saw it, A, we wouldn't all see it at the same time.
Yeah.
And B, a lot of people would assume that that video was fake in some way.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's no way, like, people would see that and be like, oh, well, this is clearly some, they're shooting a movie, or, like, they're, like, people would see that and be like, all right, this is probably fake, and then go on with the rest of their day. The reality of when this movie cuts the credits, like, it ends on a hopeful note, like, wow, now everybody knows about superheroes, but, like, they probably don't. Like,
and there's still that 10,000-year-old society that's probably going to kill them anyway. They haven't stopped anything. Like, they're all sitting there with their arms crossed, like, we did it, guys. We pulled it off. Yeah. Biggest heist in the world. Bullshit.
The biggest heist in the world. We uploaded things to YouTube.
Yeah. Also, James McAvoy just acts like a meth head. I've seen live leak videos of people doing worse things than flipping cars and eating people. This is just baby nonsense.
You know, they would first post it, and, like, the first guy to tweet it, like, put it on Twitter, would only have gotten, like, 7 retweets. Yeah. Like, nobody would have seen this for a while. And they're like, well, we posted it 2 hours ago. It should go viral any minute. What?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident M. Night Shyamalan has no idea how the internet works, and no idea how comic book movies work at this point in time. But yeah, so all those twists kind of add up together to this kind of just batshit insane third act. Does all that stuff make sense? No. Like, I don't think it does. Like, the secret organization doesn't really have a reason for hiding superheroes other than just, like, because. But
it'd be too much.
Exactly. I don't know. I think at the point where M. Night kills all three protagonists, when he kills David Dunn, he kills Mr. Glass, and he kills Kevin Crumb, I kind of just, like, threw my hands up in the air. I was like, fuck it. Like, I'm along for the ride. Let's do this. Like a lot of that stuff was very questionable. It made no sense. But, like, I appreciated the audacity to, like, when you watched Unbreakable years ago, and in your case, Mike, days ago.
I remember it.
When you watched Unbreakable and you, like, pictured, like, oh, what would an Unbreakable sequel be like? Did you picture the Unbreakable sequel to be Bruce Willis lying face down in a puddle, just drowning? Like, because that's how this movie ends. And it's like, I can't believe, like, anybody who loved Unbreakable back in 2000 was, like, satisfied with this movie at all. And I have to believe M. Night Shyamalan knew that he was doing that, you know?
Yeah. It feels like that has to be 100% intentional, especially for, like you were pointing out, Act 1 starts the way you would expect the rest of this movie is going to be.
Right.
It's going to be this, you know, superhero versus supervillain, you know, whatever movie. And then especially, like, the fake-out with we're not going to the tower, really, and all this stuff. It has to be, like, a giant middle finger to the comic book movie industry. I guess?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the thing, too. The movie builds up this idea that, like, there's going to be this big showdown. They reference it a couple times. Hey. At like, this new building that's being built in Philly, tallest building, and Mr. Glass is trying to lead Kevin out there so that David has to follow him and finally fight him so that the whole world can see what superheroes are like. So it's basically saying it's going to build up to this big, epic conclusion that you expect at the end of a superhero movie, which would have probably fell out of place in an Unbreakable sequel, honestly.
I thought we were, because Mr. Glass says, like, there's a chemical plant on the floor, whatever, I'm gonna blow it up. And I was like, I swear to God, if we get a beam in the sky in this fucking movie, I'm gonna be so mad.
But would you have been madder than what happens at the end of the movie now?
Yeah, probably, honestly.
Okay.
I sort of liked the killing of the three characters. Like, okay, so there's the like, I didn't put together that Kevin Wendell Crumb's father died on that train because I had just seen the movie.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, you hadn't rewatched Split in since it came out, right? So
yeah,
if you had just seen Unbreakable, yeah, that makes sense. You watched them in reverse order,
right? basically, So it didn't, I mean, it's not like a whoa kind of twist. It's just like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. Like, yeah, it's comic books. Yeah, of course that's what happened.
Yeah.
Which the movie tells me. like, don't you know in comic books the supervillain or the mastermind creates everyone? We shouted at the camera. And then the second twist, when everyone's dying, I was kind of into that, except for then Samuel Jackson, like, again, this is my problem. And he says, like, it was never a limited edition. It was an origin story. And then he dies. And he's like, yeah, I get what you're doing. Stop telling me what you're doing. And at that point, I thought it was going to be the three other characters were going to become, like, the heroes, quote-unquote. Like, this, David Dunn's son, Anya Taylor-Joy, and I don't know what Mr. Glass's mother would have become, but maybe the woman in the chair, you know?
Lady Glass,
yeah. The Glastress, no.
Her superpower is her bones don't break like glass, so she's just a normal person.
She's just a person that might, maybe she drowns, I don't know.
She has a really old iMac, is that a superpower? Like, that thing was buttery smooth for being like 25 years old. That's the most unrealistic part of the whole movie.
So those two twists I was into where, you know, where everyone's dead kind of thing. And then the secret society thing, like, why? I don't know. We've already gone over that.
Yeah, no, totally. So I think overall, like, I think it's a well-directed movie, too. And I will give it that. I think M. Night has always been a very good visual stylist.
Yes.
You know, and that's always been his strongest suit. Like, whenever his scripts were bad, at least, like, the movies were pretty well-directed. And, you know, there's a couple of, like, really cool shots in the movie. Like, that first shot of, like, when you see, like, the pink room with the three characters in it. Like, that looks really cool. That's in the trailer. Although I did really love... I laughed a lot at this when Bruce Willis sees Samuel Jackson for the first time when he's being rolled into the room. Because this is, like, the first time Bruce Willis has seen Samuel Jackson since Unbreakable. In the past 19 years. And at the end of Unbreakable, like, he learns this, like, horrible thing. Like, Mr. Glass did this, like, you know, horrible thing that derailed the train, murdered, like, hundreds of people, and, you know, in the process gave me my powers. But when he sees Mr. Glass, like, there's no, like, emotion out of Bruce Willis. He's just like, oh, come on, that guy? Like, come on, you're bringing him into this? What are you doing that for?
Yeah.
But I at least like the visual of them, of the three of them together. I also really dug the shot of when Kevin is wheeling Mr. Glass out of the asylum. There's the guys who come up to try to take him out, and there's the shot where, like, Mr. Glass is, like, rolling away while Kevin is just destroying the dudes in the background, yeah. Like, completely annihilating them. I loved that shot. That was awesome. That's just a very cool, like, visual touch.
I also kind of like the POV shots, like, when they were fighting each other in the lawn, where you're used to getting, like, a wide shot of these people, like, fists hitting each other, and you're just getting, like, Kevin's face, like, scrunched up. And it's, like, it's kind of unsettling, but it's really interesting to kind of see a fight like that. And they're not very good at it, either, because they both just end up, like, it's what a fight would be, is both people just grabbing each other in the neck and hoping that the other person taps out. So it makes sense a little bit, and it's super weird, but that stuff worked perfectly for me.
There's one moment in that fight that I was just, like, hysterically laughing at, where... You know, the cops show up, which I guess we find out they're not cops. I don't know who's who or whatever with these guys. And David, you know, Bruce Willis's character, throws them in, like, that container. And he's like, oh, I'm just protecting you. And he puts the bar through. And he, like, goes to bend the metal bar to, like, lock them in. And it takes him a long-ass time to bend that metal bar to lock those guys in. Meanwhile, the Beast is eating a dude behind him. And I just, like, lost my shit at this. I was like, what are you doing? Like, this isn't worth it. Like, he's literally eating a guy, like, 10 feet away from you. What are you doing?
Also wanted to give a shout-out to M. Night with his little actorly cameo thrown in the beginning of the movie, is reprising his role from Split. But then he, like, references the fact that he's also the guy from Unbreakable. And it's like, ooh, this is his first twist.
Was anyone that concerned? Like, did they need that whole, like, 2 minute, like, well, I used to be a shady guy down at the stadium. Like, who is that for?
Absolutely no one. Like,
me. I enjoyed it. I had just seen Unbreakable.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, it seemed weird that, like, that was the case. It felt like he was like, well, I made a cameo in Unbreakable and I made a cameo in Split. How do I solve this?
The weird part is he made both movies, so he put himself in that predicament in the first place. So it's like, he's like, oh, well, I had to fix it. It's like, well, you're the one who broke it. Just give up. know.
Yeah, and then he gives himself a really long scene to establish the fact that they were the same guy the whole time, which is what he does in a lot of his movies. He always gives himself, like, a way bigger cameo than he should have. Remember, like, in Signs, he's, like, the guy who...
He's the vet who kills his wife. So it's like, he could have been a throwaway guy. And there's even, like, in the beginning where they see him in, like, a pizza shop, and he walks away, and they're like, oh, that's the guy. And it's like, oh, that's subtle.
Right.
And then later on, he talks for 15 minutes and explains everything about the aliens. So, like, it's a bit egregious, and I wish he would just calm down a little.
Yes. And, I mean, he's putting himself in a cameo role in this movie. He's also inserting himself into the character of Mr. Glass, I feel like. Like, a lot of the writing with Mr. Glass's character, it feels like there's one line he has where it's like, it took me 19 years, but I finally got them together, or something like that. And it's like, this is just M. Night talking to himself, right? Writing the script, just like congratulating himself on finally writing the sequel to Unbreakable. And that's something he's done in the past too. I know I haven't seen Lady in the Water, but I know he plays a writer in that movie that is like the god of that universe or whatever. Like he plays the writer who has the power to change the world or something like that. And it's like, yeah, this, like, he just has like this insane egotistical view of himself, and I respect him a lot, like, for that. I was about to say I love him, and like I dislike a lot of his movies, but I really like the last couple of movies that he's made, and I'm really into, like, I feel like, you know, he took that critical hit. He was, I think after a while, he realized I need to go back to my roots and like do something different, and he did that. And you know, now with Glass, I feel like he's kind of going back into his old ways, but he's still, like, you know, doing a relatively low budget thing, and it's entirely on his own terms. So I don't know, it's a weird dichotomy where I'm like, yeah, I'm annoyed by this, but also, like, I'm kind of into it. It's like I feel of two minds about this movie in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that scene, that cameo scene, honestly felt so weird. It felt almost like, you know, self-serving M. Night Shyamalan stuff, and it also felt sort of like, you know, to give it more credit, like Nick did about Scream, where it's like, like this, like, commentary on this obsession with cinematic universes, where we have to explain why it's the same actor in these movies now, because right. That's how cinematic universes work. But also, he just wanted to talk about how everyone got murdered in his building, and people were scared. Yeah. Oh, also, I used to deal drugs. Like, what? Get the fuck out of here, man. Nobody cares. I don't know.
I'm excited for his video essay about how Glass was smarter than us all. It's probably going to end up being me making it, so...
Which is the final twist, and I hated it. Yeah. Not really. Where we have to have Sarah Paulson, this, you know, member of this 10,000-year-old anti-superhero society that's presumably built up this long history of how they do these things, has to get mansplained by a bunch of nerds how mastermind shit works in the comic book shop. Although they mansplain to each other, not her. But one of those guys has to be
she's
like...
She's over-hearsplaining, I believe.
Yes, there you go. They're like, well, you know, it's always a misdirect. And she's like, what? And the Kill Bill sirens go off. Like, come on.
Yeah. Otherwise, I did want to give a shout out to the sequence towards the beginning, where David does find Kevin's hideout with the four captured cheerleaders in there, because I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And again, like I was saying, like, that's kind of the movie that I think people were hoping for with an Unbreakable sequel. And it's not the movie that we ultimately get, but like the taste of that we do get in this movie, it's pretty cool. I mean, I was into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the reveal that his son is, like, you know, the guy in the chair kind of thing.
Right.
That was fun. Like, I did really enjoy the first half hour. And most of the other part in the asylum.
But it feels like we kind of missed, like, the 20-year, like, actual seeing a superhero movie kind of thing. Because it was, like, Unbreakable ends, where he figures out he has powers. And then this one begins. He's already got a guy in the chair. He's figured it all out. And then it's over immediately.
Yeah.
So, like...
Right.
He could go back. He could make the prequel.
He could.
That would be the ultimate Shyamalan thing.
Yeah. If he'd made a prequel to this movie. Yeah. I mean, he was talking about... I think somebody asked him if he wanted to do more movies in this kind of universe, and he kind of dodged the question at the time, and I was like, well, I think the story, like, I think we've done all the story there is to tell, but I'd be open to returning it at some point. And now that the movie's out, I'm like, yeah, no, it'd be real tough. Yeah. Like, I guess you could make a movie without these three characters, but, like, why would you want to, you know? So, anyway, yeah, it's, unless you guys have anything else to talk about with Glass, I think we can pretty much wrap this up. I enjoyed the movie... I would say a lot, but, like, a lot is a strong word. I would say...
It's a big amount.
Yeah, I enjoyed the movie, though. I think it's a really interesting experiment, like, a really ambitious movie. It swings for the fences, and I really appreciate it for that reason. Mike, what was your take? Overall, final thoughts.
Final thoughts. I mostly agree with you. I think I liked this movie. I can't really tell yet. And I do admire, like, what it's trying to do. The fact that it even exists. Like, we're going to make this secret superhero trilogy thing. What was it? East Rail?
East Rail 177, baby!
Who could forget it? yeah, sure. Why not, I guess. I applaud that it tried.
All right. And, Nick, your final thoughts?
It's good to see a movie where you can completely, like, time code the spot where you stopped liking it. So, I mean,
yeah, that's true.
That's something. I liked it for the most part, but I think this is where, like, the goodwill runs out again, where no one's going to really care about what happens next. So we'll see what M. Night does, but I'll be waiting for those reviews and seeing if I take another 15-year break from his movies.
Well, I'll let you know, because I'll be seeing the next one, I'm sure. I will say, I think, you know, Glass is a very divisive movie, but I think it's one that people will argue about for a very long time. You know, because Unbreakable was such, it's such a cult movie. And, you know, there was all the hype surrounding after Split came out. Like, I think, you know, now that Glass exists and exists as this kind of companion piece to both Unbreakable and Split, I think you'll see people arguing about this movie for years to come. That's my guess. Who knows if that'll actually come to pass, but that's my my brief guess. Anyway.
Hopefully it's just a speed bump on the Shyamalan assaults.
The big Shyamalan comeback. The next one is the big one. It's going to be The Happening 2.
Oh, boy.
The also is, happening. The still yeah, happening.
This is what's
Look
happening.
What's happening now.
That's Which it, is actually a secret Look Who's Talking sequel.
Or he could reprise the screenwriting of Stuart Little and make Stuart Little 3.
Oh, you know, yeah.
That'd be the power move.
I completely forgot that he co-wrote Stuart Little, so that's pretty wild. anyway, let's move off that subject. Guys, where can we find you online this week? Nick, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Downey Plus Ultra. And I still have that. I'm waiting for that cease and desist, but they can't find me. You can follow me on Letterboxd at, I think I'm just Wermuth, which is Wermuth. And I have my own YouTube channel where we've kind of fallen off viewership, and two of the people I used to review movies with aren't here anymore. So I'm doing it by myself. But that is the Unknown Film Enthusiast.
Really?
I've made 4 videos by myself, and we'll see if anything keeps coming from that. But I got this, so there's more goodwill. That's it.
All right, cool. If you ever want a guest on your Unknown Film Enthusiasts show, Nick, just let us know. We will Skype in.
I'll keep you posted.
Okay, and Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
And you can find me at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter, all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. You can actually follow me on Letterboxd as well at MikeSmithFilm. Thanks so much for listening to FilmBookCast. I'm Mike Smith, that's Mike DiCriccio, and that is Nick Wermuth. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and if you want to contact us, hit us up at MikeAndMikeGoToTheMovies@gmail.com. We will be back in 2 weeks with the second animated movie in the last 2 months produced by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, The Lego Movie 2, the second part. We hadn't really discussed exactly what we're going to review, but like, I figure that's probably what we're going to review, so I'm just going to throw the gauntlet down.
I'm not going to say no.
That's what I figured. It looks like a fun time. Reviews are starting to come in, and it looks like it's a pretty good movie, so looking forward to that. And you can also check out our next Complete Works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2014's reboot of Left Behind. And
why'd you say that like you were excited for it?
Are you not excited for Nicolas Cage to star in a reboot of a Kirk Cameron movie, Mike?
Well, now I am.
So we'll talk about that next week. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.